Do you love birds? Do you enjoy watching nature's wonders from outside in the rough or inside overlooking your yard? Then sit back for a full hour of bird calls with your chance to share your experiences or ask questions now at 203-845-3044. Here is your host, Chris Bozak.
Welcome to Bird Calls, everybody. I'm Chris Bozak, your host. I write a bird watching column for the Hour newspaper every Thursday called For the Birds. Be sure to check that out. I also have a website, birdcallsradio.com. Be sure and check that out. That's got information on New England birds and archives of Bird Calls Radio in case you missed a show. I know you don't like to miss shows, so I put them all on birdcallsradio.com so you can catch up if you do happen to miss one. Also, I started the Bird of the Day on Bird Calls Radio. Why not? I got plenty of photos in my collection, so I put a bird up every day. So, dare I say it's too hot to go bird watching? No, of course not. It's never too hot. It's never too cold. It's, you know, rain, snow, sleet, whatever. The birds are always out there. But what do birds do when it gets this hot? I mean, this oppressively hot for this long. What do they do? Well, we'll bring on Joe Warren of Wild Birds Unlimited in a couple minutes to tell you what they do when it gets this hot. I know I like to play in my pool with the kids. That's what I like to do when it's hot. And by pool, I mean one of those cheap plastic ones that you buy at the store. I don't have one of those big fancy ones, but you don't really need it. Just enough to get your feet wet. That's all I need. So Joe Warren will be on later to tell us about what birds do when it gets hot. Also later, our guest, Susan Snyder of Friends of Norwalk Islands. It's a new group, and she's the president. And we're going to find out what that's all about. Susan Snyder will be on in a little bit. I took a trip not too long ago to Erie, Pennsylvania. It was last weekend, in fact. And it was for my high school reunion. I'm not going to tell you which one. You could make a guess. I'll give you a hint. Maybe it's five. Maybe it's a little more. All right, my hint is it's a lot more than that. Anyway, so I went there and I saw a friend. I went to his parents' house for the first time in probably about, 20 years or so. And there was a pool in the backyard when I was there last. And the pool is long gone, I guess. But it was replaced with a lot of bird feeders in the backyard. I guess his parents took up the hobby of bird watching, which is good, of course. And I saw this one feeder right in the middle of their yard. And it looked a little strange. Well, I've seen it before, but I've never actually seen anybody who tried one. And it was an oriole feeder. And it's kind of like a hummingbird feeder, but bigger and shaped differently. And you put some sort of nectar or jelly or something in there. And I kind of laughed to myself, like, well, who are they kidding? These things don't work. There's no way he's going to get orioles. And before that thought even completely formulated in my mind, I looked out there and the male Baltimore oriole was on the feeder and it stayed for a couple of minutes. So I guess they do work. And then a couple minutes later, a downy woodpecker was on it. And then a couple minutes later, a female oriole was on it. So I was proven wrong over and over again, which is okay. At least I learned something. So maybe Joe will have time to tell us about some oriole feeders as well. I read about that experience in my column this week, and I got a letter from my buddy Larry Flynn. And he writes, I got an email, and he wrote, I just read your piece about the nectar feeders. I have several oriole feeders. They look like the standard hummingbird-type feeder, bowl-type feeders, except these feeders are orange, not red, plus the holes on the top cover are larger for the larger bills. It also has four indented trays on the cover for grape jelly, and half an orange attaches on the hanger hook. Of course, the bowl is filled with sugar water, plus it has four perches. I've had up to six male orioles using it at the same time, plus tons of youngsters and females. Not only does this attract orioles and hummers, catbirds, red-bellied, downy, cardinals, and a few others enjoy it also. And Larry says, now is the time to put these feeders out as orioles are about done with their nesting and are starting to disperse throughout the area. Larry also writes that his wife went out to the backyard with a bright red dress on, and a male ruby-throated hummingbird flew right up to her and kind of studied the dress a little bit and then flew off a couple seconds later. So thanks, Larry, for the email. And, I guess I learned something this week about oriole feeders. I should give those a shot. I forgot to mention, we have Chris in studio. Chris, how's it going? Chris is my main man here today.
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks. All right. So let's have Chris bring on Joe Warren from Wild Birds Unlimited in Darien, and we'll find out what the heck these birds do when it's so hot. You there, Joe?
Yes, I am. Chris, how are you doing today?
All right. Let's talk about what birds do when it gets hot, and then if we have a couple minutes at the end, you could tell us about some oriole feeders and what to do with them, and if you have them, and how to maintain them. But let's start with the oppressive heat and humidity we're having. What are the birds doing, Joe?
This heat, they're doing exactly what you and I are doing, Chris. They're trying to avoid the heat. This kind of weather is oppressive for humans, and it's oppressive for birds. What you'll notice if you look out in your yard is less bird activity during the heat of the day. Birds will spend much more time in the shade. They'll roost in the trees and in the bushes rather than being out flying around. They will try to stay in the shade. Now, when human beings get overheated, when we go out on a hot day like this or the way it's been for the last few days, we sweat. The body sweats to get rid of heat. The moisture forms on the body, it evaporates, and that process of evaporation is what helps to remove the heat from the body. Birds have no sweat glands, so they cannot do that. What birds do is they take blood and move it to those areas of their body that are not covered by feathers in an effort to dissipate heat. The two areas on a bird are their feet and their bill. And so you'll see birds perched somewhere, and what will happen is their system is geared to pumping blood to areas like their bill and their feet to dissipate this heat.
Okay.
The other thing they'll do is you'll see larger birds, crows, robins, some of the larger woodpeckers, and their bill will be open. They'll be panting like a puppy dog does.
Hmm.
And this is an effort to move air over their tongue and over those surfaces, again, to try to drive some of this heat off of the body.
Okay.
The biggest problem birds have is that any of these activities that they use to try to dissipate heat also tend to dissipate moisture. And so they need to take in moisture at this time. They'll get it from natural streams or lakes. They'll get it from our backyard bird baths. You mentioned earlier that you like to go soak your feet in a plastic pool out in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
Birds will do exactly the same thing. They will go to a bird bath and just stand in the water to put their feet in the water in an effort to dissipate that heat from their feet.
Okay. Yeah, it certainly works.
Cool, to watch them do these things.
Yeah, it is. And water, of course, I mean, we've talked about water before several times, but water is also important at this time for drinking and stuff. So you have it's important to keep your bird baths maintained this time of year, right?
It is, and especially when we get, again, this oppressive type of heat. The bird baths tend to get warm. You want to put fresh water in them regularly so that the water stays relatively cool. You also want to watch this type of warm weather will encourage algae growth in your bird feed, in your bird baths.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to make sure that you keep them clean, either by actually scrubbing them and putting fresh water in, or there are a number of good algicide products on the market that are enzymes. These are not toxic to birds. It's an enzyme that will keep algae from growing in your bird bath. And we do carry these type of products in the store.
Okay. And you have selection of bird baths
as well. Just like us, birds are trying to dissipate heat. Every now and then you'll see a bird ruffle its feathers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons they'll do that is to move hot air that gets caught under their feathers away from their body. A bird's body, as I said, they have no sweat glands, so it doesn't breathe the way a human's body does. And the hot air tends to get trapped underneath their feathers. So every now and then you'll see them just ruffle their feathers, and that's another effort to get rid of all that hot air that accumulates.
Okay. Now, before we go, Joe, we have a couple minutes, so I wanted to ask you about, we talked a couple weeks ago, and you talked about the some of the myths of bird watching. I always thought that the oriole feeder was a myth, and that you never get an oriole to your to your backyard if you put one out. But I guess I've been proven wrong on that. Do you have a selection of those, and what tips do you have for some oriole feeders?
Actually, orioles, as we had said once before, orioles are beginning to make a comeback in this area as trees, the big tall canopy trees like the hickories and the sycamores, begin to mature. They provide places for orioles to build their nests. And so we are beginning to see a rise in the oriole population in this area. Orioles like nectar, much like a hummingbird does, but less sweet than a hummingbird. When you mix nectar for a hummingbird, you're putting one part of sugar into four parts water. When you're mixing nectar for an oriole, it typically is one part sugar to six parts of water.
Okay.
So it's a little less sweet. As you mentioned, an oriole, typical oriole feeder will have a place where you can put grape jelly on it. Orioles like grape jelly.
Okay.
And I'm not talking about anything fancy here. Plain old Welsh's grape jelly
just
out of the store.
They find
it's
the stuff you find at the store. Wow.
The biggest difference in the oriole and the hummingbirds in terms of the way they drink nectar, hummingbirds tend to hover. Orioles need a perch, so a good oriole feeder will have a perch, a place where the bird can land and dip its bill into the nectar to drink the nectar. They have been known to come to oranges. You take an orange and cut it in half and put it on an oriole feeder that's designed for it, or just put it on a nail on a tree stump or on a log, and orioles will come to that. But it's not that they're eating the orange, the flesh of the orange. Mm-hmm. They're drinking the orange juice from the orange. And again, it's the right sweetness. It's like a naturally formed nectar for them to eat.
All right. Now, if you put out an oriole feeder or even a hummingbird feeder, going back to the heat now, how often can you, or how often should you change it or check it to make sure it's not rancid?
In this kind of weather, you really need to be looking at changing that nectar every 2 to 3 days. It's sugar water. If it overheats and gets warm in this type of weather, it gets rancid. It goes sour.
Mm-hmm.
And the birds know this. And if the nectar begins to go rancid, they won't drink it. And if they don't, they'll be looking elsewhere for a food supply. And then it becomes a little more difficult to get them to come back.
Yeah, okay.
So you do want to keep an eye on those. Now, the fact that it's sugar water, they're not difficult to keep clean. A little bit of warm water, rinsing them out, and then dry them off and put cool nectar back in it,
mm-hmm.
and you're off and running again.
Okay. All right. We're about out of time, but tell us how to get to your place and your new summer hours.
You can come to our Darien store on Heights Road. We're at 356 Heights Road, right across the street from the Narotan Heights Railroad Station, next to the post office on Heights Road. We have changed our hours for the summer. We are now open from 9:30 to 5:00. 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday. We're closed on Sundays. And for the most part, we change our hours because a lot of people go on vacation this summer and they're not around to justify keeping the store open.
Okay.
Come on into our store and mention this radio show, and we'll give you a free 5-pound bag of bird seed.
All right. Great deal. Well, I certainly appreciate your support of the show, and we'll be talking to you again next week.
You got it, Chris.
All
enjoy
right.
the weekend and keep cool.
All right, you too, Joe.
Take care.
All right. So that was Joe Warren of Wild Birds Unlimited in Darien. He and his wife, Pat, also have a Wild Birds Unlimited place in Bedford Hills, New York. So check out those places. And we'll be right back with Susan Snyder of Friends of Norwalk Islands right after these messages on 1400 WSTC, 1350 WNLK.
Do you love farm fresh foods but don't always have time to make it to the farmers markets? You'll love Graze, an artisanal food company delivering fresh, wholesome, and sustainably produced foods directly from Vermont family farms to your door. Graze delivers to Fairfield County customers every Monday. Signature products include grass-fed Angus, pastured organic pork and poultry, cage-free eggs, organic yogurts, wholesome milk straight from the cow, including the best chocolate milk you'll ever taste, award-winning artisanal cheeses, and smoked meats. Try their delicious home-baked pies and an array of healthy prepared foods, including soups, salads, sides, and entrees, made with all natural and organic ingredients. If you're on a gluten-free, vegetarian, and paleolithic diet, Graves has foods for you, too. Their small farmers take great care in how their foods are produced, how their animals are raised, and how they treat their land. You can taste the difference. Go to GravesDelivered.com or call 1-888-WE-GRAZE.
Hi, this is Chris Bozak, host of Bird Calls Radio, which airs every Saturday from 3 to 4 on WSTC WNLK. I'm inviting you to visit my new website, birdcallsradio.com, where you will find archives of past Bird Calls radio shows, the bird of the day, other birding information with an emphasis on New England birds, and links and logos to advertisers and supporters of this show, Bird Calls Radio. You will also find how to advertise on Bird Calls Radio. So visit birdcallsradio.com, the official home of Bird Calls Radio.
Welcome to the Wild, Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, where you can turn your backyard into an unlimited oasis of natural harmony. With birdhouses, feeders, and baths, no-waste seed blends, and a great selection of garden and gift items, Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop is any nature lover's paradise. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, in Bedford Hills, New York, and now in Darien, Connecticut.
Do you know about the birds and the bees?
No.
For more bird background, read Chris Bozak's column weekly in The Hour. Or call now with your comments and questions at 203-845-3044. Here's more Bird Calls with Chris Bozak.
Now back to Bird Calls with my dad, Chris Bozak.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Chris Bozak, your host. With the Bird Calls, and we just heard from Joe Warren from Wild Birds Unlimited. And as promised, we're here with Susan Snyder. She is the former director of the Norwalk Seaport Association and is now has left that organization to form another group, Friends of the Norwalk Island. So welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Tell us briefly what Friends of Norwalk Island is. And actually, you don't even have to be brief. You can Tell us what the group does.
We are a nonprofit organization that partners with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service and other organizations to conserve and build awareness and advocacy for the Norwalk Islands. The Friends of the Norwalk Islands is a designated friends group of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and what that means is that we're part of a national network, so to speak, or national initiative by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to support their friends groups to help with volunteer efforts, educate environmental education, and just connecting people with nature.
Okay. And obviously there's a focus on the Norwalk Islands. What is your interest in the Norwalk Islands and why the Norwalk Islands?
Well, I'm from Norwalk, and as my tenure at the Norwalk Seaport Association, I was when I first initially got very involved with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and, you know, the refuge. A lot of people, I don't think, are aware that actually four islands in the Norwalk chain are part of the Stuart B. McKinney National Wildlife Refuge. The Stuart B. McKinney National Wildlife Refuge has seven other units along the coast of Connecticut. And I just felt that it was a very important thing for us to be able to, you know, really promote that. Well, build awareness, really, in the community and just starting to get people outside and appreciative of what they have in their own backyard.
Okay. All right, great. Now, we're recording in southern Connecticut, and we're on the coast of the Sound. And but we also are on the Internet worldwide. So someone who's not familiar with the Norwalk Islands, we're on the southern coast of Connecticut, and mm-hmm. In the southwestern corner of Connecticut is Norwalk, a couple towns up, and off the coast of Connecticut are some islands. You know how many there are, and some are part of it, or some are part of the National Wildlife Refuge, some aren't. So tell us a little bit about the Norwalk Islands themselves.
Well, I think depending on the height of the tide, there's about 20 to 25 islands. Some of them are just hammocks or little rock outcrops that, of course, when it's high tide, are covered. I think people internationally should know that Norwalk is also in Long Island Sound, which is part of the New York City metropolitan area. So I think that gives people a feel for the amount of population that there is around these islands. And the islands have a very colorful history. They have, they've been privately owned for probably hundreds of years and so forth. But probably the last 30 years, they are now owned by four of the larger ones, which are Sheffield, Chimin, Peach, and Goose, are part of the National Wildlife Refuge System. Grassy and Shea are owned by the City of Norwalk. Kokini is owned by the town of Westport. And then the remainder of them are privately owned. Which they're small islands, but they have homes on them, and I don't really know for sure, but I think people live out there all the time, or seasonally anyway, I guess.
Yeah.
So I would say it's about 5 or 6 miles in length, from Westport down to the tip of Sheffield Island, and it's a large recreational area. There's, a lot of kayakers. I happen to be an avid kayaker and bird watcher, and so I'm out there a lot. But there's also a lot of motorboats and people anchoring and swimming and so forth. So it's an excellent resource for us. And also Norwalk Island, from a cultural point of view or an economic point of view, it's still one of the largest oystering places in the East Coast or the United States.
Okay. All right. So tell us, I've been out there several times, so I kind of know, but I think people are sick of me telling them. So what, in your words, tell us what kind of wildlife and stuff are out there. And some wildlife is good, and I like to think of all wildlife as good, but sometimes wildlife is not always good. Is that the case in the Norwalk Island?
Yeah, I would say so. I think you're absolutely right. The Norwalk Islands are important to migratory birds, and that's one of the initiatives of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is that, one of their mandates is to protect migratory and colonial wading birds. And the Norwalk Islands, being a major stop and resting area on the Atlantic Flyway, used to, in old times and, before it is what it is, be a major habitat, especially for egrets and herons and so forth, and I don't think a lot of people know this, but, egrets, they nest in trees. And I don't think a lot of people really understand that. And then what happens is they nest in the trees, and then they come ashore, to feed into the salt marshes and into the wetlands. So what's happened out there is that the islands are not regenerating themselves. So, and that has a lot to do with invasive plant species that are, destroying the native trees and bushes that, pulls them down so that the birds don't have a place to nest or to rest. And then there's also mammal predators. There's a lot of deer and raccoon out there that also eat the the eggs and the nest for those birds, like killdeers and so forth, that nest on the ground. So, and then of course the birds also that nest on the ground are also susceptible to human disturbance. Mm-hmm. The people that come out on the beach and you can't really see their nest because they're very mm-hmm. camouflaged in there. So
yeah.
So I think what the first initiative that we need to do is try to control the invasive plants and then get some of the native indigenous vegetation back so that these birds can survive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, you said something, you said lots of things that are interesting, but one thing caught my mind, and we will get back to that after a short break. So we'll be right back with Susan Snyder, the president of Friends of Norwalk Islands. We'll be right back here on 1400 WSTC, 1350 WNLK.
Do you know about the birds and the bees?
No.
For more bird background, read Chris Bozek's column weekly in the hour, or call now with your comments and questions at 203-845-3044. Here's more bird calls with Chris Bozek.
Welcome back to Bird Calls, everybody. This is Chris Bozek, your host. We're on every Saturday from 3 to 4. And if you miss a show, don't worry. You can always get it at birdcallsradio.com. So that's birdcallsradio.com. That's got the archives. It's got the bird of the day. And, I'll let you know who's coming up on next week's show if you follow that. Right now we're here with Susan Snyder, president of Friends of Norwalk Islands, a relatively new nonprofit group here. Now, you had mentioned that deer and raccoons go out and destroy some of the habitat. Now, again, for people in Norwalk, they probably know this, but somebody listening in California or Spain, how the heck do the deer and raccoons get out to the islands?
Well, I understand the deer swim. The islands are, I think, at the closest point, maybe a quarter mile to half a mile away, so it's quite doable. I personally have seen them swimming. yeah. out there. And the raccoons, I'm not sure that they do the same thing, but I bet you once they're out there, they start to breed and just kind of expand in numbers. So
yeah.
that's what they do.
Yeah, and the tides can get pretty low around here,
yeah.
so there's not a lot of deep water separating the mainland from some of the islands.
Exactly.
Tell us quickly how you went about forming this group, a friends group. How does one go about, say they have a patch of woods or something they like, and there's a couple other friends organizations around here. So how do you do that?
Well, we're specifically friends of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. And in that regard, we wanted to help with environmental education and awareness for our refuge here in the state of Connecticut, which is called the Stuart B. McKinney National Wildlife Refuge. And those folks are headquartered up in Westbrook, Connecticut. There's 10 units, again, like along the coast of Connecticut, Faulkner Island, which has a lighthouse on it, Salt Meadow and Westbrook. There's one in Greenwich, Calf Island in Greenwich, and Milford and Stratford all have areas that are designated, you know, owned by the Fish and Wildlife Service as National Wildlife Refuge. So when the idea came up, I gave the refuge manager a call, and I said, you know, would you be willing to, you know, work with our group if we were to form, and we'd be very happy to help with education and different programming. And he said yes. So we just started to explore, you know, what it is we would like to do. It's very much a partnership, and it's very much working with the refuge manager and his, you know, with under what his goals are and his vision is for the Stuart B. McKinney Refuge and how that particularly would fit into the Norwalk Islands unit.
Okay.
So.
All right, good. Well, I'm glad you went through those steps and
yeah,
made the effort.
And I also did the same thing with them with the city of Norwalk, because they do own a couple of the larger islands. And mm-hmm. I said, you know, we can expand. We're not stuck just with fish and wildlife. I mean, we can certainly expand and work more with other community groups. And my thought was that there's so many of us smaller environmental groups around, like, you know, the Norwalk River Valley Watershed, and now there's Norwalk River Valley River, the Trail and all that, Save the Sound and different organizations, that it would be nice if we could all come together at some level mm-hmm. at some point and work together to conserve what we're also passionate about out there in the Norwalk Islands.
Yeah, that's usually how the real results get done, is when people
collaboration,
work together.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Okay. Well, one of the things I like about this new group and a lot of nonprofits, including your old organization, Norwalk Seaport Association, and a lot of the nature centers and things, one of the things most of these nonprofits do is they get kids involved, because kids are you know, obviously going to be the mm-hmm. future, and if people are going to protect habitat in the future, we may as well get them started young. So what are some of the things that you guys do to get youths involved in conservation?
Well, it's interesting you brought that up, because last week I had the privilege of attending the National Wildlife Refuge Systems Visioning Conference, which was held in Madison, Wisconsin. And the National Wildlife Refuge System is currently undergoing its 10-year plan. And they brought together there was 1,000 people there. There was about 100 of us friends were invited to come, because they do look for our input into what we'd like to do. And one of the topics of conversation over the week was what they call urban refuges. Now, I think, as we all know, living in this part of the country, which is technically part of the New York City metropolitan area, that, you know, our young people are really getting further and further away from nature, and they're not connecting. You know, they think that tomatoes come from the grocery store and, you know, milk comes from the case, you know, in a yeah. cardboard box. So and many, many studies have shown that being in nature or just engaging with nature, even 5 minutes a day, is very good for our mental health, our spiritual health, our physical health. And with the children these days, you know, with not getting outside and not exercising properly and so forth, and all of the health issues that come along with that, it's more and more critical for groups like ours to really somehow get those kids outside and get them connected. Because if we can give them the experience of putting their feet in the water or seeing a bird in its natural habitat and not on TV or behind a tank or a cage, you know, it can show how they can then become that our future conservationists. And I bet you, if you think back, you know, what was your connection? I think back to how I was brought up. It's probably a lot our our parents getting us outside, and mm-hmm. whether it was hiking or skiing or backpacking or just saying, you know, go outside and come back at dinner time, mm-hmm. has probably instilled in us a love and of nature, and which is why you and I do what we do today.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In that regard, what we do is we're offering several education programs. Our major one is called Nature of Learning Initiative, and this is actually in the schools. We delivered that to 5 elementary schools this past spring, and it involved 3 weeks of classroom lessons, and then the last week of the session, we took them out to Shimon Island on the Fish and Wildlife's Landing Craft Boat, which was a real hoot because the kids got a real kick out of that boat. It's fast, and it's kind of cool,
yeah.
and, you know. So that was a lot of fun, and we actually reached 376 children.
Oh, that's
you know,
great.
Went through this program. It's fourth grade. It matches the state of Connecticut guidelines for science, language, arts, and social studies.
Mm-hmm.
In April, we had the WOW Express here, which is Watershed on Wheels. That's a habitat trailer that was put together from the Silvio Conti Refuge, which is up in Hadley, Massachusetts. Silvio Conti is actually the Connecticut River watershed is National Wildlife Refuge, a lot of it from Vermont to Connecticut.
Okay.
And now, currently, our third program is our nature photography, and this is for children 10 to 13. It's being held Tuesdays and Thursdays down at Calf Pasture Beach. It's part of the City of Norwalk's Recreation and Parks Summer Program, so anyone can look at our website or give us a call or the city's website on how to sign up.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing is we're providing cameras, and the kids are walking around Calf Pasture, again, that getting them outside. And
mm-hmm.
it's not so much about taking the picture, but visualizing nature in their own backyard. And as you know, Chris, from Calf Pasture Beach, you can also see all of the Norwalk Islands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, as I can say to all those who are listening that live in Norwalk, you know, Calf Pasture Beach is a phenomenal place to experience the Norwalk Islands and to learn about the wildlife that's out there.
Okay, yeah. And I guess this holds true for all nature, really, but you never know what you're going to see. And a couple weeks ago, I brought my son, Andrew, who's 8, to Calf Pasture,
mm-hmm.
and we were going to go horseshoe crab tagging with Maritime Center.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Schneerlein was out there, and we met him. We got up. I got him up at 5, and if anyone's ever tried to wake up an 8-year-old at 5, you know, it's not the easiest thing to do. So I got him up, and we got there, and the horseshoe crabs were basically not there. So I got him out at 5 in the morning, and there were maybe, there were maybe 30 horseshoe crabs, but there was a handful of volunteers already. So he didn't get to do a whole lot of tagging of the horseshoe crabs. But as we were about to leave, it went from somewhat of a disappointment morning. One of the guys in the group said, "Oh, come here, I found a dead eel." So Andrew got to hold a
dead eel
that was probably, I don't know, it was about 3 feet long, and it was as long as he was, and it wasn't in the best shape, but they can get their hands dirty at this
mm-hmm.
age. That's good. So I guess you just never know what you're gonna see and what's gonna spark an interest in the
absolutely
in the kids.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So what have you seen from the kids at the nature photography? What kind of things make them excited that you've seen?
Well, the birds, of course. And we were very pleasantly surprised last week that there actually were egrets. There's like a salt marshy grassy area on the western side of Calf Pasture towards where that monument is and the flotilla building, you know, where it's more tidal. Get sandbar in mm-hmm. there and so forth. And there was actually an egret feeding or fishing
mm-hmm.
there, and they're really excited when they actually get close, you know, when they can actually get close to these things.
Yeah.
And and even more amazing was when we took the kids out to Shimon. I mean, many of these children had not even been on a boat, let alone on an island.
Yeah.
And they were just in awe of what it was like to be out there. So it's just really fascinating to see their reactions.
Yeah. So how many kids got to get on the boat at the same time?
On the same time, there were only 20, 25.
Okay.
We did it for a full week,
mm-hmm.
and there were several trips a day. So all told, there was about 376 kids went out there. It was from Jefferson Science Magnet, Naramac, Tracy School, and Rowayton Elementary School.
Okay.
had the pleasure of going out there. So we're hoping next year to expand the program and involve more elementary schools. We only reached 5 of the 13 elementary schools in the city of Norwalk. So we're hoping that we can perhaps start a little bit earlier or somehow get more schools involved. So,
okay. All right. I've been on the boat several times, sometimes with the Maritime Aquarium or Seaport Association, mm-hmm. and or just with Larry Flynn out there. It's almost like a different world out there once you get, you know.
Yeah, it is. You could be any place else in the world except in Norwalk, Connecticut.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And we're very lucky to have that. I hope that more people appreciate it than perhaps you think. One of the mm-hmm. difficult things is that there's no real public access. You know, unless you know someone that has a boat, or you take the Seaport's mm-hmm. ferry, or you pay, or the aquarium's boat, or you kayak, you know, you don't really have mm-hmm. the ability to do that. And one of the initiatives in Fish and Wildlife in service and in these programs is about diversity. And, you know, how do we reach that population that doesn't have the opportunities that you and I may have had when we were children? Mm-hmm. And that was really what was more fascinating. Some of these kids, you know, live, you know, right down there at the water, and they have, like, no idea.
Yeah.
They've never been out there, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't know what's out there. So it's great that you're growing out there and showing them. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned kayak. I know you're a kayaker, so tell us a little bit about what maybe some kayakers out there should look out for in terms of birds. And I understand you have a kayaking event coming up with your group.
Yeah, we hooked up with the small boat shop down on Water Street this summer, and we tried to have a bird watching paddle actually in the end of June, but unfortunately the weather didn't cooperate. Mm. However, we're hoping to have a cookout paddle on August 21st, is a Sunday, and we're hoping to cook out on Shea, and then we'll take a trip, a little ride over to Shimmin, a little paddle over to Shimmin, and we'll talk about the refuge and so forth. So mm-hmm. the small boat shop has partnered with us, and a portion of the fee will go as a donation towards the Friends of the Norwalk Islands. So that's very nice of them and generous. Okay. If you're a kayaker out there on your own, I'd say just kind of keep your eyes open. There are, I think, Chris, you even reported on the Island Keepers. There are two Island mm-hmm. Keepers on Shimmin. Mm-hmm. They are, I think, Jason and Elliot. And okay. they're interns for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And they're out there living this summer, and they're really there more for educational purposes. So if you happen to go up on the beach, you aren't supposed to walk into the interior, but if you happen to see them or go into where they're living, you know, they're there to mm. kind of talk to people and explain what's going on. But
okay.
And I think you're the expert. I mean, I think we're a little late in the season for the nests, right?
I think there's at least some.
No?
Some are still nesting and maybe going through a second go-round with the eggs and stuff, and there's at least still young that are still susceptible to predation and being scared off and things.
So I'd say if you're a kayaker and you see the signs that says, you know, area closed, just respect the signs, because they're there for a real reason, and it's no fooling.
Yeah.
Because the birds mean a lot to us, and without them, we wouldn't be very happy people.
Yeah, that's neat that the Island Keepers are out there. I was going to maybe try to set up a timer. I could go out there and spend the night with them sometime. I don't know if that's going to be allowed or not, but that would be pretty cool. And then obviously I write for a newspaper too, so I mm-hmm. get a good story out of that.
Yeah.
Well, I'll pursue that. Anyway, we're going to take another short break, but we'll be back with more with Susan Snyder, the president of Friends of Norwalk Islands, right after this short break on 1400 WSTC, 1350 WNLK.
Do you love farm fresh foods but don't always have time to make it to the farmers markets? You'll love Gray's, an artisanal food company delivering fresh, wholesome, and sustainably produced foods directly from Vermont family farms to your door. Gray's delivers to Fairfield County customers every Monday. Signature products include grass-fed Angus, pastured organic pork and poultry, cage-free eggs, organic yogurts, wholesome milk straight from the cow, including the best chocolate milk you'll ever taste, award-winning artisanal cheeses, and smoked meats. Try their delicious home-baked pies and an array of healthy prepared foods, including soups, salads, sides, and entrees, made with all natural and organic ingredients. If you're on a gluten-free, vegetarian, and paleolithic diet, Graves has foods for you, too. Their small farmers take great care in how their foods are produced, how their animals are raised, and how they treat their land. You can taste the difference. Go to GravesDelivered.com or call 1-888-WE-GRAZE.
Hi, this is Chris Bozak, host of Bird Calls Radio, which airs every Saturday from 3 to 4 on WSTC WNLK. I'm inviting you to visit my new website, birdcallsradio.com, where you will find archives of past Bird Calls Radio shows, the bird of the day, other birding information with an emphasis on New England birds, and links and logos to advertisers and supporters of this show, Bird Calls Radio. You will also find how to advertise on Bird Calls Radio. So visit birdcallsradio.com, the official home of Bird Calls Radio.
Welcome to the Wild, Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, where you can turn your backyard into an unlimited oasis of natural harmony. With birdhouses, feeders, and baths, no-waste seed blends, and a great selection of garden and gift items, Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop is any nature lover's paradise. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, in Bedford Hills, New York, and now in Darien, Connecticut.
Do you know about the birds and the bees?
No.
For more bird background, read Chris Bozak's column weekly in The Hour. Or call now with your comments and questions at 203-845-3044. Here's more Bird Calls with Chris Bozak.
Welcome back, everybody, to Bird Calls. We've got a couple more minutes here. We're with Susan Snyder, the president of Friends of Norwalk Islands, a relatively new nonprofit organization here doing good stuff for conservation of our birds and nature. We want to thank our sponsors today, obviously, Joe Warren, Wild Birds Unlimited especially, and everybody who supports this show and all your listeners. And be sure to check out archives on birdcallsradio.com. So we are here with Susan Snyder, President Friends of Norwalk Islands. And you recently went out to Madison, Wisconsin for the National Wildlife Refuge System Conference, Conserving the Future Wildlife Refuge and the Next Generation. So what else did you pick up out there?
Well, it was just an inspiring week altogether. I know the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was there, Dan Ash, who's just newly been confirmed as a director. The Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, spoke one day, and there was just a lot of great keynote speakers and inspiration. And it's just overwhelming sometimes when you're in a room, 1,000 people of like-minded people who all share the same passion and desire to, you know, conserve our natural world. And the one point I wanted to make, though, is that it was very timely because Stuart B. McKinney National Wildlife Refuge, which is our refuge here in Connecticut, is also going through its planning process. And the public input piece of that was closed on this past Wednesday. So it was really great that I was able to take what I had learned and seen from at the national level and then be able to have a really good conversation with our refuge planner as to how I think some of those national initiatives can happen here in the Stuart B. McKinney and what we can leverage and, you know, what we can do better. And one of them is they make a really large point about partners and friends groups, and partners can be everywhere from state agencies, all the various DEP agencies, to, you know, groups like ourselves. And I think we all need to learn how to work better together and collaborate, and that's the only way that we're really going to get the word out to the masses and make a really big impact about why it's so important for us to preserve these lands.
Yeah. I'm sure there's only so much the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service personnel can do, especially on a place like this refuge is so spread out. I'm sure there's only so much they can do. So the more groups like yours and more people like you, the better.
Well, and if you're following the news and you see what's going to happen with the budget, you know, there's talking about major cuts in the service. And I just would ask people, you know, get involved and, you know, be aware of some funding cuts that might actually impact us here at Stuart B. McKinney. So from closing refuges to not being able to hire staff to reduce law enforcement, I mean, it's just a whole – we've come a long way in 30 years. It would be a shame to start losing a lot of that.
Yeah, and a lot of those areas, you know, they need need people like that. Just, you know.
Especially where we live. It's a whole urban refuge thing. I mean, there's a lot of people here, and it takes an enormous effort to just not only conserve it, but, you know, somehow get it to a point where people understand that it's important not to throw litter there and to destroy it and stay off the beaches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
a lot of people
pay attention to those signs.
Yeah, that's, you know, the more people out there, like the island keepers who are out there now. It's not like a lot of people aren't. They just, for lack of a better term, they just don't know. They don't know better. They're not educated. So the more people out there to.
First time the island keeper's been there in 30 years, so I think a lot of people are like, wow, what's this? And plus they put a bathroom out there, so of course that just, you know, everybody wants to go. But they're there for a reason, and it's actually great that our refuge has taken that step to put those young men out there, because it's about the education.
Yeah, and I also like the title of the National Wildlife Refuge System Conference, the Conserving the Future Wildlife Refuges and the Next Generation. My first guest on the show, very first guest, was Mylan Bull. He's a Connecticut Audubon, and he is a big part of the Connecticut State of the Birds report, which they do every year. And every year, they focus on something specific. And I got to scoop right here on Bird Calls Radio that next year's focus on the state of the birds for Connecticut is going to be the next generation, how to get more
the
people involved
people,
in birding and
exactly
preserving.
Right.
So,
and we spent a lot of time talking about that at the conference last week, about how to do that and some of the things that other people around the country are doing to engage these kids and you know, young people in nature.
Yeah, okay, so we've got a couple minutes left, and obviously you are Susan Snyder, President of Friends of Norwalk Islands. It's a relatively new group, so tell us what your goals are for the future and, you know, what expansions you might have in mind for your group.
Well, please, you know, stay tuned to our website or Facebook page. We'd like to get, you know, get the conversation going on our blog, and we're going to hopefully be expanding our education. Like, as I said, continue with getting into more elementary schools for next year. We're also would like to expand our nature photography program. Right now it's just in the summer, but we'd like to perhaps do something all year long and reach more into the high school kids and perhaps young adults and get them interested in nature photography. And then, you know, the long-term vision would be to work with some of the other friends groups in the Stuart B. McKinney Refuge, which there are four other ones, you know, like Outer Island and the Thimbles and Calf Island, and, you know, somehow form an alliance or some kind of a collaboration partnership where we can all leverage our assets and do what's best for the refuge in general. So that's our long-term vision, is education and activities and just connecting people with nature.
Okay. And I'm sorry if I missed it. If you said before, do you have a website for the organization?
Yes,
and
it's www.friendsofthenorwalkislands.org. Our office is down at Calf Pasture Beach in Norwalk Cove Marina, so feel free to come visit there anytime. We have a Facebook page, and so friend us, like us, whatever. And as soon as I figure out how to Twitter, we're going to start tweeting all over the place. So stay tuned. We're going to be around.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. That was Susan Snyder, President of Friends of Norwalk Islands. Follow me on Twitter, Bird Calls Radio. Check out birdcallsradio.com. And we're here every Saturday from 3 to 4. And we'll see you next week here on Bird Calls on 1400 WSTC, 1350 WNLK.